Welcome to the Buy 180 podcast with Alex and Bryce. I'm Alex Pearson-Jones.
And I'm Bryce Krawczyk.
This show is about powerlifters, not just about powerlifting. Each week we discuss the experience of lifters as it relates to the sport and our lives as a whole. Sometimes these talks confirm our biases, and sometimes they do not. This week we've got Garrett back, Garrett episode 2, and we're going to talk about some of the structural things within CPU predominantly, which is where Garrett's area of expertise is, but also kind of IPF and how that kind of parallels a little bit with British powerlifting here, and it seems to be an appropriate time as the AGM has just gone by over here in the UK. If you like this episode, please consider hitting subscribe, leaving a comment, letting us know what you'd like to hear more of in the future, guests, athletes you might want us to have on. You can always DM us on Instagram, and yeah, rate us, let us know what you think, and let the boys know that you came by and, you know, checked us out. So Garrett, thank you for coming back. Both Bryce and I felt like we didn't quite get into it quite enough with you on some of the more, I'm going to say political in like inverted, you know, quotes, in terms of structurally within the CPU, IPF, how those different things function. I think it's, as the sport has grown or it continues to grow, I think there's more misunderstanding in terms of how the procedures and the structures work. And kind of letting people know a little bit more about, okay, well, if you have this opinion or you want this thing to change, like, actually, you know, people can actually make a pretty big difference in terms of how these different things are set up moving forward. And, you know, how can they actually implement change rather than just kind of like, you know, screaming at their phone and typing mean messages into their keyboard. So with that being said, what is your role within the CPU and within kind of like your own region, and kind of how did you end up getting there, and what does that kind of look like if somebody wants to follow a similar pathway? And Bryce, I'm not actually sure of your involvement with your kind of like local region, how that works and how running meets works and that sort of stuff. So if you just kind of take the floor here, boys, and kind of let them have it.
Okay. So currently I'm the president of the OPA, so of the provincial body within the CPU, and then in regards to the CPU in terms of committees, I sit on the coaching program development committee and the equipment approval committee. So basically both committees are designed around growing the sport a little bit further. The coaching program committee is trying to pick up where a previous program started and kind of develop a CPU oriented coaching program to educate new coaches from the local level through the national level, and then kind of help build out a international coaching presence within the organization itself instead of relying on something like just the IPF program. And then the equipment approval committee is something that I put forward when ER, Titex, and a few other companies withdrew their approval from the IPF. So as it stood, the CPU was using the IPF approved equipment list. The problem you run into with companies leaving that is obviously there's a gap to fill. I know like in my region, ER racks are to date the most common rack you're going to see. I mean, mm-hmm. I know myself, like I have four of them, and that's what I use for my meets for the most part. So those not being approved would immediately remove meat directors from the circuit, and then thus you get less meats, less availability. The sport kind of flutters for a little bit until people either step up and spend, you know, the 10 grand to get a brand new Leica rack, or they rely on the Federation to buy equipment and then kind of lease or rent it out accordingly, which I know some provinces do really well. It didn't go well in my province. It lasted about a year, and then the previous executive kind of just auctioned everything off because it went to crap pretty quick. But yeah, those are my current roles in the CPU and the OPA in an official capacity, and then in a non-official capacity, meet director, and then just volunteering at events, things like that, to kind of help the sport where I can.
Yeah. And me, honestly, I just referee more or less. I try to get into whatever I can in terms of refereeing and being part of that like volunteer army that's necessary to keep powerlifting running. But I don't actually go above and beyond for any committees or official positions or anything like that. So, like I said, I think Garrett's going to have a lot more insight on some of this stuff. But
so, how did you get into those Like, what did that look like? I mean, there are, if it's anything like the UK, there are a ton of roles that need to be fulfilled within a federation for it to run smoothly. And there are lots of vacancies very, very often over here. Did you just kind of put yourself forward to one of these roles? Did you kind of create any space? Like, obviously you mentioned about the equipment stuff. Like, did you just kind of see a need and you just kind of pivoted and said, hey, we need to do this to make sure that we still have a region and can run meets and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. So prior to this, I served on the committee in 20, I think it was 2016, 2017 as a regional chair. So the way my province works is obviously like Ontario is a pretty big landmass. So we divide it up into regions and we assign regional chairs to kind of be point people for development of the sport in those regions. So I worked as the Northern Ontario chair, which is like a massive landmass. So for those familiar with Canada, it works from basically just north of Toronto to Manitoba. Like it's huge. Like you can drive for 15 hours and still be in that region. So it's massive, and there's not a lot of powerlifting happening in that region. Still to this day, it's hard because it's just so much land and so few people spread between it. So it's really hard to get those events going. But yeah, that's where my first role with the organization was. Unfortunately, it was a non-voting role. So anytime something came to a vote, I was allowed to express an opinion, but I had no actual vote in the matter, and it just felt very hand-tied throughout the entire process. So you're sitting there, you're listening to things that you may not agree with or you may agree with, and you're watching these motions die on the floor because you don't have a vote. And then obviously, like I got frustrated, I stepped away from the position. I was like, okay, like nothing good is coming from me being here. Nothing is happening in the region that wouldn't happen without me, so there's no real need for me to be here. Then COVID hit, and I was very vocal with I was very vocal with my opinions on what I thought was not being done to support the membership in Ontario. Ontario took a massive hit to membership, which obviously like funding follows membership. So there's no members, there's no funding. There's no funding, there's no development of the sport in the region. And it just got to the point where my frustration boiled for a year and a half, and then the AGM was approaching. And I just said, okay, well, instead of complaining, I'm going to actively trying to do something. And I put my name in, and I unanimously was voted in, and here we are.
And just for a bit of context there, like Ontario makes up what, 50 plus percent of Canada's overall membership?
Going
Is it more, less?
into, sorry, prior to COVID, it was around 50 to say 55%. Now, obviously, Ontario's still regrowing in terms of membership. I'd say it's a primarily distributed between Ontario, BC, and Quebec, with Ontario and BC being the two largest representations. I think Nationals is usually a pretty good indicator of like size of federation. And if we look, like BC obviously was host province. They had around 240, 250, I think, participants, individual participants, and Ontario was 200. So I mean, for it not being a kind of like home province meet, that's still a very large representation. But yeah, we're probably in and around that like 40% of the federation right now, if I had to take a guess with the numbers in front of me.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of what happens in the OPA kind of really does trickle through to the bigger picture of the CPU, right? Because there's so much of that membership coming through that province. Like, that's really going to dictate potential courses or change courses for the CPU at large.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, like, Ontario is also one of the more vocal provinces when it comes to bylaws, rule changes, things like that. Like, anything, a lot of the good and the bad comes out of Ontario because, again, Ontario is just going to Ontario and everyone's got an opinion and going to be the loudest person in the room at all times, which can be great for the sport, but also can be kind of gatekeeping and cumbersome at times as well.
So you meant, sorry, man, go on. I was just going to ask and kind of rewind a little bit about, you mentioned about not having a voting role. So how does that kind of infrastructure work now? Like, are there, so what happened recently at the AGM over here was there are motions that put forward, and then people can kind of go to an AGM and basically, vote for that motion. There are a couple of issues in terms of like it had to be in person, all these things, which is hopefully changing for next year. I believe have been now confirmed for next year. But, can people, can a random member put forward a motion? Does it go to a board? How does that kind of whole infrastructure work for you guys?
So when it comes to the actual AGM, so the AGM we have alternating years. So 1 year will be like a bylaw year, 1 year will be a positional voting year. So like your executive committee can be voted in, new members can be voted in, changes, things like that. And every year we take bids for championship events. So your provincials, junior, sub junior, open, and centrals and national bids, things like that. In terms of voting, so when it comes to the AGM, every member with a valid membership is entitled to vote. What we've pivoted to in the last bit with our assumption of the executive has been moving to a more virtual space. The reason being, in person is very problematic. Like this year, for example, had we tried to do it in person, there's just no way to do it. Like you would normally host it at a provincial championship because that's where you're going to, it just makes sense. There's more people going to be there as is. The problem with that this year, for example, was our vice president, Daniel Rumula, and myself were two of the meet directors for the event of a 400 person, 3 day event. There's no way we're fitting in an AGM in that time span. And I mean, like the OPA AGMs on average can go from like 5 to 10 hours, depending on what topics are being brought up. And I mean, like CPU AGMs have gone 15, 16 hours sometimes, just depending on topics.
And so they're entirely online, like the CPU AGM and the OPA AGM are
Yeah,
online
currently,
now.
I think the CPU is talking of returning to an in-person structure, because the CPU AGM is closed door to voting members only in terms of provincial bodies. So every province has their president, vice president that would attend, and all provinces have equal number of votes in the matter, as well as the CPU executive has votes. In Ontario, for our AGM, for example, every member is able to vote. We have a formal policy or bylaw change process where it has to be submitted 2 weeks before the AGM and vetted in proper format. And in that time, the current bylaw or policy has to be listed, the change has to be listed, and the reason for change has to be listed. Then during the AGM, the member that put forth the motion is given the floor to explain the motion, at which time the motion goes to a vote. Again, because it's been virtual, we vet everyone's membership as they enter the AGM, so we know everyone has a valid membership. And then we have a secret ballot box app that our web admin uses that takes the votes. And then we have someone oversee and verify the results as well. And then that's how motions move forward and how positional roles are filled.
So, in terms of a motion getting changed, then they would have to say, I don't know, say there was something, a good example that we've had that was in 2020, I believe. Somebody put a motion forward to our AGM. So, effectively, like just the British, there's no kind of like, I mean, there are regional ones, but effectively, the British AGM's kind of over here where you would go to make a significant change. And they put forward about non-supportive clothing to like cover up skin for like personal belief reasons, religious reasons, whatever that might be, which was voted in and was kind of accepted in the in inside of British powerlifting, right? So certain folks can't show their knees or their elbows or whatever and need to cover that up for for whatever reason. So that was obviously voted in, and that was just basically put forward at our British AGM and then gone for. Over with you guys, would that go through like a regional level first, and then you guys would carry that forward to like the national kind of CPU?
So a lot of that stuff, we adhere to the IPF in a lot of those regards. So like that specific rule you're talking about, that's also an IPF rule. where the IPF does a pretty good job of like actually presenting images of approved and non-approved, and we kind of just use that in that regard. The only real deviation that comes to mind offhand would be the equipment list is the only thing we're really changing. Everything else, the CPU for the most part kind of leans into the IPF rulebook in terms of approved equipment and stuff like that. I know there's talk of some provinces trying to create their own lists and things like that, but that's a whole nother thing because then they're in breach of CPU policy, and then that has to go to a vote, and then a special meeting has to get called, and there's a whole chain of events that, that unfortunately stem from that and occupy a lot of time.
I was going to ask, Garrett, because you kind of heralded in a bit of a big change with the organization of like the OPA and kind of a changing of the guard, going from like a majority, you know, older guy powerlifting executive to now more younger and probably more diverse board. What drove you initially to, you know, put yourself forward and go through all of that? You mentioned, you know, a lot of stuff sort of at the tail end of COVID, and I think I know a fair bit of this backstory, but like what were the things that kind of, you know, pushed you to do that? What were some of the like main things that you wanted to change, and have you been successful with those?
Obviously, like coming out of COVID, the big one was no events happening. That was in part, obviously, like the sport needs meet directors. But the province at the time was also handcuffing them with a lot of additional restrictions above and beyond what the province was saying had to be done. So like Ontario didn't have a meet for 2 full years. There was just no events.
Mm-hmm.
The only event that happened was a CPU event happened in Ontario, which clearly proved you could run events in Ontario. And that just kind of added more fuel to the fire of being fed up. Mm-hmm. But basically what happened was I had gone to a few Ontario weightlifting events, which operates under more or less like the same scope that the OPA would. It's probably the most direct comparison where it's a meet, it's a function inside a venue, water rules, all of that stuff. And it was just obvious, like they were executing multiple events every month successfully with no issue. So at that point I went to the OPA and I said, like, look, we can make events happen. I'm happy to be involved. I'll do the legwork. I'll make it happen. Even if it's like virtual scoring, virtual reffing, whatever it is, like there's something we can do here. And the OPA at the time, just kind of very stuck in their ways, not wanting to adapt, just said flat out, nope, we're not doing it. And that's it. There was no discussion. There was no nothing. It was just, we don't want to do it. We don't want to be involved. So we're just not going to. And that's really what kind of started getting things moving. And then there's a few nudges from some people that I kind of rely on in terms of the organizational side of stuff where, they said like, you know, you should run, you would have the support, like you should do this. And that obviously helped. And then from there was having been on the executive and seeing like one person's vote doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things, like my vote, president or not, does not sway the opinion of everyone else. It has to be an open mind group that can understand different views and opinions and kind of work together to make that work. And from there, I reached out to people I thought would be very key, influential people in the organization. I reached out to Dan about coming on as VP because, again, between Dan and myself, respectfully, I feel like we have two of the larger clubs in the province. So just in terms of internal reach we have and like kind of feet on the ground talking to members, I feel like we both have a good idea of the direction of the sport. And from there, Dan and myself just kind of started reaching out to people we felt would be good fits for roles. And it was the first time where successfully, like, everyone showed up, everyone put their name forward, everyone was voted in. And from there, like, I feel like we've done a lot of good. Like, one of the big things was just, like, communication with the membership. Like, the OPA would be radio silence for 3-4 months. And then there'd be, like, an email blast that would go to everyone's junk mail with no real updates. And it was just like a very out of touch way of talking to people. So like one of the first things was get in, update our social media presence, create more in tune ways to get in touch with our membership. Like if a primarily our membership is junior and open, they're not checking their email for updates. And if they see an email, they're not reading through it. They're looking at Instagram. They're looking, some of them at Facebook. Like that's where we're getting in touch with them. So we've really made a push to kind of meet our membership where it is and make the information more available to them where they're going to see it, in place of us just putting up on a bulletin board and saying, well, if you don't see it, you don't see it. So like we're really going out of our way to make sure everyone's as informed as possible. And then just a few other like changes we've made. One of the problems, obviously, reffing. Like I mentioned.
In what way? What do you mean reffing?
So
as a problem.
So Ontario is, as I mentioned, is a big province. There's a lot of space to cover. Covering that space gets very costly. So working with our CFO Manette, we developed a proposal to create more funding opportunity for our referees. To better pay our referees for travel, accommodations, things like that. And then just to ensure like meets happen and have enough people there. We went from a province where we had, I think, 15 active refs coming out of COVID. We now currently don't have enough meets happening to okay or sign off on new refs. Like we have like a 30-person wait list of creating new referees
positions. For the refing exam.
Yep. That's our officiating officer, Adele. She revamped the entire program, took it online, and again, met people where they were instead of, well, you've got to drive 6 hours to do this in-person course that you might fail. So again, we just kind of really updated a lot of the procedures to make it make a little more sense for our membership. And we've seen a really big growth in terms of involvement in the sport. Obviously, again, like the area we need to directly attack now is a few more meet directors. And volunteers are always challenging to come by at big events. So those are the two areas we're focusing on now going forward into the next term.
And can you talk about any of the strategy to try to, like, how do you cultivate or like encourage more meat directors in an area? Because you also mentioned that like Northern Ontario really spread out, really kind of hard to get things going there. Have you had any success up there?
So we've had conversations with clubs out there and a university out there, and basically like nothing is said and done. But where it stands now is for events to happen out there, it's I put equipment in a trailer and I drive it out there and bring them equipment to use, and then I pack it up that night and I bring it home. That's kind of where we're at now, just because, again, the initial cost of equipment is probably the biggest hurdle for a lot of people. Once you run your first meet, like, you've got a little bit of money in the bank, you can buy some plates, you can buy some bars. But right now it's creating a network of gym owners and meet directors that are willing to share equipment to kind of help those new meet directors get off their feet. And again, I know there's a few that we've talked to that are very interested in doing it. And it just providing a little more guidance and help along the way. Like one thing Dan and myself have done is now with new meet directors, we hop on and we do a Zoom call. And we have them like walk through the venue and show us everything and show us what their thoughts are and kind of their vision. And again, Dan and myself have run quite a few events together and apart, obviously. So we have what I would say is a pretty good eye for what will make sense, what won't make sense. And we just help steer them in the right direction for what could work, what might be problematic down the line, what's allowed within the current policies and bylaws, and what's obviously not allowed.
I feel like something like a standardized CPU meet director's handbook would be just such a great thing. I'm not sure if that exists. Hey, you have one just in Ontario or?
So I'm not sure if other provinces, I'm sure a few other provinces must. But we have like a standardized, like 15-page handbook of like, this is what your platform should look like. This is where the ref should be sitting. This is what you need in terms of like rough space. This is how far everything should be apart. This is what you should do for like your score table, your backup. This is all of that.
So maybe that's just an Alberta problem that I've heard about from a few meat directors, that there's just like not enough of that knowledge being passed around, kind of thing. Each meat director that steps into the role basically has to try to like kind of figure it out, or, you know, seek out people who have done it before. So,
I mean, like I'd encourage everyone to look at the OPA meat director handbook in that case. Full disclaimer, I know we have some policies and things that might not be universal across all provinces, so I would double check a lot of that stuff. But for a general structure of everything, I think it works really, really well, and it's pretty informative. And I know Christine, our administrator, she goes through and updates it anytime policy changes or anything like that, so it's pretty up to date with the ins and outs of Ontario, at least. Yeah, and again, just like trying to provide resources when and where we can definitely helps. But it's always going to be an uphill battle. I mean, like the problem you're at now is, and it's not a knock on juniors, but like juniors are a majority of the sport. Junior lifters are not out running meets. You have older open or masters lifters. Those are the people running the meets. Those are the people volunteering. And then it comes to like people complain on social media, meat directors get fed up, and they're like, okay, well, this is not worth me losing $100 and giving up my weekend to do, so I'm just not doing it anymore. So that's kind of the problem with where we're at now, is we just need some more youth to get involved, even at like the volunteer level of meets, and see how things work, and then eventually have them kind of pick up the torch and start doing some stuff on their own as well, I would hope. Because otherwise the sport dies pretty quickly.
I think that's kind of a natural circle of things though, right? It's like you compete for a while and then, I don't know, maybe it takes a couple of meets to kind of recognize like, oh, wow, there's really a lot that goes into me being able to enjoy this sport before it kind of like you have that aha moment. But
yeah, like, yeah. I mean, like running my first like two or three meets was great. And I like loved the stress and anxiety and like, holy shit, I don't have this wire, or I need to go to Walmart at 2 a.m. and get an extra screen, or I think we brought you out for, I think it was like the third meet we ran in that arena where we had like multiple,
the big APS one.
Yeah, we had two powerlifting meets, a CrossFit event and a strongman event all happening at the same time.
Ambitious.
Oh yeah. My lord.
And I remember like I was doing the powerlifting side, and I remember the morning of, we didn't have a stupid power cord. And like I drove to two different Walmarts, Best Buy, Staples. I went to probably 30 stores to try and find this, only to figure out it was sitting in the back of my car the entire time. And it, like it was.
And I remember standing outside of a like metal shop, like a shop that makes the metals, 2 minutes before they were supposed to close, and like just straight knocking on the door for like 10 minutes before this dude came out of the back. Door was locked. I had to pick these medals up. It was like Saturday night. Meet was Sunday. I was like, I'm not leaving, man. Like, I got to get these medals. Yeah.
Yeah, but again, like, I don't know. Like, I might be different in the sense of, like, I thrive off of that. Like, that.
Mm. Yeah, I feel you there.
Yeah, I don't know.
The chaos, man. It's stimulating.
Into it. Yeah.
One of the questions that I have, I suppose, on the whole CPU situation, I don't know if this is predominantly like a British thing or what it is. In terms of membership fees and in terms of cost of entry fees, that's been a big kind of point of discussion over here a lot, in terms of the board presenting a financial report every year. You know, they're effectively always needing to be more money within the sport so we can do more tests, so we can run better events, et cetera, et cetera. Now, myself personally, I always have looked at the CPU and Australian powerlifting when it was more of a thing, which I think they've kind of rebuilt now, actually, and are kind of getting back into a better position. But you guys is kind of like our closest comparables in terms of like number of members, how competitive we are on an international kind of scene, all those sorts of things, in terms of like, you know, just general size of federation. So do you know roughly kind of how many members there are in the CPU, and then kind of roughly what, you know, what a membership fee is kind of per year for the CPU in terms of, you know, working out like how much money there is potentially disposable and that sort of stuff. I'm guessing it gets shared publicly each year at like the AGM and things like that, or?
Yep, I don't have the financial report in front of me. I mean, the big expense I'll point out is our drug testing expenses. Like we're around $100,000 a year. So that's a massive expense for us. I know this year we're aiming to increase by 50%, which is ambitious. So basically anytime the CPU creates more funding, that more or less goes right back into testing. That's like our primary expense. That's where all the money goes. This year there was a slight bump in the coaching fund, I guess we'll call it. The word escapes me. So I believe all coaches got a slight bump in their stipend, and they created a paid position for like a paid intern. Again, not much, but there's more money in it than there was previously, which is a step in the right direction, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like membership wise, I know there's a push to increase membership cost. I think it's around 100, 120 now, Canadian, give or take.
It's split between provincial and national. So I think you pay like 65 or 70 bucks to your national for your federate or for your membership, and I think 65 or 70 bucks to your provincial. Now those numbers
they're going to vary province to province. Like I know Ontario voted not to increase its membership fee this year and to explore it next year, but the Ontario portion, for example, right now is 40 bucks. So again, like it's around like 100, 105 bucks for the CPU and all in. So again, like there's not a ton of money in the sport itself. Like a lot of the provinces kind of operate with like very low overhead and kind of just skate by the skin of their teeth, where like one big drug test failure could bankrupt a province easily. I know there's some provinces now, similar to how I believe you guys just got NSO status. So you guys are nationally funded now, right?
It's complicated. But no. So basically, happened with British Powerlifting last year is we got recognized by Sport England. And effectively what that's meant is they pay for, I think it's 20 or 25,000 worth of drug testing. Two things basically happened. One, instead of British Powerlifting directly organizing when we pay for drug testers to be at meets, that's now completely centralized somewhere else. And then they pay for it. They pay like a stipend towards us doing that. So so effectively they kind of knock off an amount of the bill that we get every year for drug testing, which still doesn't really cover it. I think it's 20 or 25,000, and we spend about £50,000 a year on drug testing. So I think almost comparable to you guys, but not quite as much. I just pulled up the AGM minutes from last year for you guys, and you guys had 2,619 members. I imagine that's probably grown a little bit because 2022 was still a little bit touch and go with COVID. But I mean, considering the amount that you guys spend on drug testing, and you guys are about 60% of our membership, we've got about 5,000 members, and you pay more into drug testing. That may be due to like CSCS and, you know, the actual cost per test, but also, you know, even then, like you guys are still doing a fair amount more testing, which I think everybody across the board everybody wants everything to improve, right? They want bigger and better events. They want to pay less. They want bigger and better events. They want more drug testing. They want, you know, they want all these things to go up without anything extra going in, which I think is the time. And I think that, like, you know, really, like, as an organizational structure, I kind of look up to the CPU because you guys do a lot of things very right in my opinion. I remember, I think it was you and I, Garrett, chatting about kind of like, obviously I'm massively biased here, but like the coaching stipend and some of the things that like, you guys have an international structure. You take less coaches, but those coaches are well looked after at that international level. You're able to kind of do X, Y, and Z things, and it kind of means that like there's more from the federation side of things there that you can enforce a higher standard across the board. Because people aren't effectively volunteering or paying their way to go and do things. And then secondly to that, it's kind of like you guys can uphold a much higher standard in terms of you need to do X, Y, Z course and you have to do, all this stuff from the wider side of things and you have to be, I don't know, volunteering, you can create a huge criteria. Whereas if it's like, you've got to pay for your own flights and your own hotel, and you've got to pay the IPF hotel rates, and you've got to be there for 2 weeks. Like suddenly, how many people are going to put in, 2,000, 3,000 pounds just to go and volunteer at a meet for 2 weeks, not sleep? Like, that's a narrow band of people, right? So yeah, you really got to love it to do for sure. So yeah, I mean, I think something's obviously gone right. I've also seen here 2022 CSCS expense CCES expense was $40,000 in 2022. So again, it's probably gone up a fair amount. I haven't read this whole thing though. I literally just saw the number in the CCES. There's probably more going into testing than that, but you guys have a coaching budget that is significant, which is awesome. And obviously a bunch of other things. If this isn't that interesting to our audience, which I'm thinking it's probably super interesting for 2 or 3% and probably not that interesting for the rest. In terms of kind of boiling it down to more of like a local meet level and things like that, what kind of changes are you guys trying to drive forward within the CPU or with your own province, and kind of what are kind of some of the bottlenecks that you've seen? Obviously the participation side of things we've kind of already mentioned, more meets, higher quality meets, all that sort of stuff, but are there any kind of bottlenecks or things that you guys have really run into in terms of just running as a federation or accessibility for, a newer lifter or something like that?
So the one thing we're trying to do is create more grassroots events. We're in this weird spot where all of our events are happening in like halls, hotels, and like banquet halls, which again gatekeeps because like the daily rate for something like that is say $2,500. You need it for 2 days, so like your baseline $5,000 to run an event before you've even rented the trailer, got the medals, anything, right? So trying to create events in that grassroots fashion where we can put them on in gyms that can properly facilitate the event. We've tried with some gyms, and the problem is just like size, space, layout may not be ideal. So that's been like the biggest hindrance right now is finding those lower overhead venues where we can actually have events happening. It's getting better, but again, it needs to still improve. And then looking to regulate cost of events, keeping in mind the actual like rate of a venue. Like I'm not sure like Bryce what it is for you guys for a meet, but we have local meets that are like $160, $170 sign up.
Yeah, I think that's $165, I think, is the last I saw on entry forms, and I think it's been like that for a couple of years.
Yeah, and I mean like I remember not many moons ago, my first national, I think my first nationals was like 150 or something. So obviously like the price is just going up and up and up. And I wouldn't be surprised like for our provincial championships if we're over that $200 per event barrier this year or next year, because again, that's just kind of how inflation is working right now. But yeah, really trying to create more of that grassroots feel, while keeping in mind like the fees we have to pay to the CPU as well. Like Peach, I don't know how you guys do your drug testing fees, but like for us, if you have 10 people sign up at a meet, you owe $150. It's $15 per person, is paid directly to the CPU for drug testing. And then that's just off the top of whatever the meet director fee is. So if it's $100, $15 off the top goes to the CPU, and they collect that for drug testing paid out. And that's paid directly by the meat directors. So trying to find a happy balance where we can cap how expensive these local events are going to be while keeping in mind the cost of venues and like drug testing expenses, things like that, is definitely the biggest hurdle over probably the next 2 years.
Yeah. And that's probably echoes like what I've... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I honestly don't know in terms of the UK over here. It seems to be... how do I say this? It could do with transparency. So I've hosted a fair few local meets over here, probably 4 or 5 maybe since kind of 2015. And effectively the people that I've worked with have just been like the people in the region to kind of organize, you know, how much we're charging, what the costs are, all that sort of stuff. It's kind of always been, I've effectively been told how much I'm allowed to charge and how many people I can have in. And then they're going to send down X number of refs and all that sort of stuff, which is fine. I have kind of have no issue with it. But again, you know, we run into a similar problem. Like I always hosted them at Elite, so like the gym that Bryce, you've been to, and like we've hosted them there and it's been great. But the only reason that, I mean, I still lost money in the last one that I hosted. I think it cost me just over £500 to like end up running the meet in the end when I had to buy a few things and whatever, which people don't realize, I don't think. But the cost even then, because we paid for White Lights meetings coming into a live stream, it was like, you know, relatively expensive for the UK, but I mean, it's still basically nothing. So we charged £50, I think. It might have been slightly more for that meet day with a live stream and, you know, comp equipment in the back and all this sort of stuff that you kind of, but it was just in the gym. Admittedly, it wasn't like, you know, in some like USAPL Nationals type standard of event, but it was cheap, man. Like it was around about $80 Canadian, roughly. So obviously you guys are talking about charging around about twice as much for a regular kind of local meet, potentially without like a fancy live stream and, you know, all these other like bells and whistles that, you know, we're trying to put onto it over here, which I think might just be due to just like British people's natural, you know, reserved nature. We tend to be very like prudent and very like don't want to spend a lot of money, and you know, cost of living is really, really high and all that sort of stuff. But like we have to get to a point where, and unless there's some angel investor into the sport of powerlifting, like people can't be expected to lose money on events. You know, like like again, very narrow bandwidth of people that are going to be like, okay, yeah, I'm going to give up a week of my time and have all this like restless, you know, stuff and set up over a whole weekend and, you know, like beg, borrow and steal to get this event and to get this venue and whatever, just to then lose money on the event itself. It's like, oh, you know, because what I want to, because I love the sport and I want to let a lot of people like lift. I mean, sure, like do it. And, you know, I want to try and help, but ultimately it's very, very hard to make that work. And I don't know how that problem gets solved unless you start charging more money. Or you start running, you know, events that have just got shitloads of people in it and people have just got a chin like a 12, 14 hour meet, which nobody wants, right?
Like provincials was, I just pulled it up in front of me, it was 378 athletes over 3.5 days, two platforms. And again, like this is a meet where we cannot cap the number of lifters because it's a championship event in our region. Mm-hmm. The operating expense for a 3-day meet, looking at the budget, was $68,980 it cost us to run a 3.5-day event. Now again, like this was a big meet. There was hotel rooms had to be paid for. There was a lot of stuff that had to be paid for. But like to put that in perspective, that meet lost $3,800. Like, and that's a meet that is mandatory and someone has to run it every year.
And as of now, you can't cap the lifters. So it needs to be as long as it needs to be, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, like the only way you cap the lifters is you increase the qualifying totals. But Ontario historically has some of the highest qualifying totals you're going to see in Canada. Like our current provincial QTs are higher than the regional QTs, which is wild to me in most weight classes. So it's one of those things where there's a lot of provinces, and I'm sure there's a lot of like counties and regions in other countries where they're too big, but not big enough still. Like they're too big where they have to run these massive events that they just can't fund because, like in Ontario, we've been trying to get PSO status, so like provincial sport organization status, and because we're not an NSO yet, we don't qualify. And I know like that's a huge priority with the CPU. Like if the CPU gets NSO status, it's like an instant 150K right to the sport right away off the top. And at the provincial level, that would equate to Ontario getting like, say, 20-25K a year in government funding, provincial funding. And then you start getting that. It's like, okay, now we can put equipment in circulation this year. And then next year, it's okay, we can buy the live stream stuff and we can supply live stream equipment for these events. And that, like, you can really kind of develop and build out the sport. The main thing is just getting over that hurdle. I think that's where a lot of individuals in the sport are, is like they're just waiting for that funding to happen. Like I know the CPU talks about it every month, just like where we're at with NSO status, and I think we're like 16 months waiting for a reply from the federal government, and it's just been sitting, like it just moves at such a
longer now.
the strike, so yeah, I think like for Canada specifically, like that's kind of what gets us over that hump, is once we get NSO status, I think there's going to be a pretty big spike in the development and level of the sport at the organizational point, where you're going to see probably funding for like some of the executive roles. You're going to see these turn into not just like volunteer side jobs, but they're going to turn into like part-time paid positions where like people can allocate like 20 hours a week and really develop the sport a little more thoroughly. Cause like that's part of the problem, where it's all volunteer hours, right? Like if I look at my schedule, it's probably like 30 hours a month just given to the sport, where it's like answering emails, doing Zoom calls, talking to lawyers, talking to meet directors, going to events. It's a lot of just volunteer, and that's part of where the problem is. Like people aren't really willing to just give the hours right now, because they want something in return, and there's nothing in return outside of you just like powerlifting, right? So I think it's just a few more years NSO status and people kind of finding their love for the sport in place of finding their love for being a competitor in their sport, if that makes sense. I think those are like the two big things with growth and development, money being the biggest, obviously.
And where do you think outside of the obvious kind of like cash injection potentially from like NSO type status, where do you think the kind of bottleneck is at the moment? Like, do you just think it's outreach? Do you think it's number of members? You know, it seems like you guys have kind of got it better than we do if we think about relative number of members versus what you guys are already able to do. Like I mentioned earlier, I see you guys as actually being kind of in front of British powerlifting in a lot of ways in terms of what you're able to do, both in terms of amount of drug testing, quality of the highest level competitions that you guys are running, in terms of being able to fund coaches, those sorts of things seem to be in front of where we are, even though you've got just a smaller membership body. If you would think about like should be, if we've got twice as many members, you would have thought that we would be in front of you guys, right? In a lot of ways. So you know, where do you think the kind of the bottleneck is for you guys in terms of, you know, if NSO status gets delayed another 3 years, do you see CPU continuing to grow, continuing to get better? Well, I mean, where do you kind of see that going towards? What do you think the kind of limiting factors are at the moment?
I think the sport's going to continue to grow. Like if you look at the trajectory, like obviously it's not like 2018, 2019, where it was just like an, you know, GameStop to the moon kind of graph. But you're seeing like a pretty steady creep of membership coming in still. I still think the bottleneck is always going to be number of meet directors or number of meets available. Like you can sign up for whatever sport you want, but if there's no games, there's no meets, there's no events, you're not going to continue, right? Like that was when I played lacrosse. We had one team we would play every weekend. And I say, okay, like this just isn't fun. Like there just wasn't enough teams in the federation at the time, right? So I was like, okay, well, I'm not doing that again because that wasn't fun. And it's the same thing. Like your first local meet is great. It's supposed to be a good experience and enjoyable. But if your only option is to every 10 to 12 months do the same meet, you're kind of going to get bored of it, right? Like you're not going to want to go do the same thing over and over and over. So more meets to open up the avenue to like those higher levels. Cause like the big picture of the sport, like your first meet is supposed to be part of like your feeder system. Like you do a local meet, your local meet would qualify you for provincials. Provincials qualifies you for centrals, centrals, nationals. That's like the tier of kind of how you're supposed to do things. The issues we have is, obviously like our schedule getting messed up for the next 2 years with nationals moving is problematic. Because like the order of which you're supposed to do these things doesn't make sense now. But then also like if there's no events, like say you miss your QT by 2.5, like I had a girl this weekend, missed her QT by 5 kilos. So she's missed her QT. There is no events from now until provincials for her to try and get it. So her year's done. So it's April and like she has no reason to compete again until not this September, next September. And say, okay, well, are you going to keep that person as a member in your sport for a year and a half? Are they going to pay for another year and a half to not be able to compete? Probably not. And then like you look like when we look at the average like term length of a membership, the average member is only in the CPU for 3.5 years. So if we're already only keeping them for 3.5 years and then they have no pathway to like move up to these other events and they're just kind of stuck at these local events if they can get into one because they sell out in 24 hours.
Hours, yeah.
They're not going to stay, right? There's no incentive for them to stay if they can't do anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, why would they, right? Like, why would I pay somebody $100, $200 to do nothing? I can't answer a meet or I don't think I'm going to be able to do it. Like, sure, I'm just going to... It's just charity at that point, right?
I mean, that's why people register for their memberships is so they can do a competition, right? If there's no competition to do, like, you're not just going to pay to be a member. Yeah. And I also think like that's what gets people into the sport, right? Even if you just go and like watch your, you know, somebody in your family or a friend or whatever, you go and watch somebody compete and then all of a sudden you start thinking, well, maybe, I don't know, I could give this a shot kind of thing, right? Like I'd be surprised at like how many, or I think, yeah. Anyways, it'd be a large number of people who like spectate a meet or volunteer at a meet or are somehow otherwise involved in a meet. You know, gym's closed for the day. What the hell's going on in here? Go in and watch and be like, oh shit, powerlifting, cool. You know, like that's, I think every avenue we have to get more people into the sport. And yeah, also I think probably a big like wound in the side of people lost to the sport when there's a lack of it.
Yeah. And I know like Ontario used to run an expo event. It was an international for a little while, the Toronto Super Show. It was the one where who popped?
Jamal Browner.
Jamal, yeah. So that's the one where he popped at, and then immediately it was no longer an international meet the next year.
Very Arnold-esque kind of thing, right?
Yeah, and it's
it was like Canada's version of that.
It's a big bodybuilding show. There's weightlifting. There's strongman. There's CrossFit. There's a marathon going on outside of the venue. Like it's this massive, massive display of like strength sport, and we're no longer in it. And like it's mind blowing because like that event cost the federation $0. The venue was given to the meet directors to do because they wanted powerlifting there, so there's no cost. The average attendance was 25,000 people through the gate, so you have 25,000 people. Half of them are gonna see it. Right. And say 1% of that decides to sign up, like that's a huge uptick in growth of the sport from one event. And like mm-hmm. our old executive said, it was too much of a burden to put on. So they just kind of ceased all communications with them and let it die. And I've been trying to get that back for 2 years now. And they don't want to work with it because they've realized, oh, this is a prime 6-unit space. We rent that for $4,000 a day. So $4,000 a day. And it's like, okay, well, here we are. So it's short-sightedness has really kind of hindered the growth, and it just sucks. But yeah, getting those events happening is definitely the biggest hurdle everyone has to deal with. And like, I look at everyone else's like provincial schedule, and it looks like everyone is doing less meets. Like across the board, mm-hmm. there's just less meet directors. And again, like, I don't know if that's like the later effects of all of the lockdowns and closures and all of that stuff, people just being like, okay, I'm done with powerlifting, or if it truly is just like a cost to benefit ratio of like, this costs X amount more. I'm just getting shit on by kids all day because I'm not letting them bring their cameraman. This is not fucking worth it. Right? Like,
sorry, Garrett. You're obviously talking about Dylan, right?
I didn't even think of that. But yeah, Dylan, specifically Dylan. But like, I've gone to local meets. And again, like, I see it both ways where, like, having that kid with his, you know, 13-inch lens close up, putting his knee sleeves on, like, cool. That's going to get people watching the sport. But then at the same time, it's like, okay, that guy's also a massive hindrance in the warm-up room where he's in the way. So it's one of those like weird kind of, this helps the sport but it hurts the sport, and you got to figure out which one is kind of coming out on top. But for the most part, like you again, like you have like there's a meet in Scarborough. There was a flight of 14 people, and I remember standing in the back counting. There was 8 coaches all holding like DSLR cameras recording, and it's like, you guys aren't getting attempts in time. You're missing and going up. Like, you guys are making all these silly mistakes because you don't have a coach, but you're getting sick footage. Yeah. And it's like, so I don't know. I think like leaning a little bit more on media package providers to give that kind of exposure is a step in the right direction. And mm-hmm. It fills that void of, okay, well, now you can get the footage you want and you're happy and you're getting a good meet experience because your coach is there.
And actually coaching you, not just getting the sick angles.
You missed your opener on depth and went up 25 kilos to make sure you got that sick PR for your edit.
I mean, that kind of stuff's never going to not happen, right? Even before cameras, people were going up 25 on a missed opener. Like, we're all meatheads here, you know? More similar than we are different, I think.
Like, if you're not going to hit a PR, it's not worth being there, right?
But I see what you're saying, yeah.
But yeah, like, that's kind of where we're at. So it's tough. But I'd still think, like, overarching more events and catering more to, like, the crowd. Like, it's not the powerlifting meet of old where it's single ply and a bunch of dudes in the back drinking beer. That's not what the sport is anymore. So we need to get away from that idea and really lean into what the membership wants. And if they want mm-hmm. media crew, try and get a media crew. Like, they want live stream. Like, live stream is like a big ask at every local meet now. Is like, is there a live stream? Like, make sure there's a live stream. It's not, you set up your phone on a tripod. It's not a great live stream, but there's a live stream. There's something, right?
And I mean, like, even with a pretty basic setup, like we've live streamed stuff here on and off. We've done our form check Fridays and live stream training sessions and stuff. And there was a meet not long ago that Danny ran, and I basically just like took my laptop and one camera and a couple of cords and just set it up with the same, you know, Streamlabs, whatever else that I would use to run one of our streams. And it wasn't perfect, but there was at least like an official live stream, and I was able to commentate. And I think, yeah, people were incredibly, incredibly appreciative of that, because, I mean, again, it's a big ask to get people in the same room a lot of the time. So, like, if you're, you know, competing and you're excited about it and you're dedicating much time to this, like, your family and your friends want to watch. They want to support you. And again, if they can't do that in person, then, you know, maybe they can do that digitally. And digitally, it's still going to have that impact of people watching it being like, hey, this is actually kind of cool. And then maybe wanting to get involved in some way, shape, or form. So just to echo that, yeah, live streams are great, even at a local level, even if it's not perfect and it doesn't look like, you know, Sheffield, where the cameraman's getting that insane shot of like the Gavin Aiden Keiko like rivalry, the anime power up moment, like, you know, we're not all going to get that, but even a basic live stream I think is a huge, huge step, and definitely worth like probably investing some of that money for meat directing in.
And I think like one of the lowest hanging fruits, and what I've done with all of my meats for the last bit, is whatever media company I work with, I just throw that into the negotiation where I say, okay, like, you guys get media rights, you guys get package rights, you guys have to set up a camera for the live stream and operate it. And yeah. I've had zero issue. They do it because they all have extra cameras, and they just set up a camera. They've got someone going over checking it every now and then. The live stream's good, and you're set, right? Yeah. So like, there's definitely ways to cater to those audiences. It's just, again, like a lot of our current meat directors in Ontario are just kind of dated. They're not very willing to kind of take that step forward and change how they've done things. They've done it this way for 15 years and they're not going to change because it's worked for 15 years, right? Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, like, their meets are getting less and less traffic every year, and they're at the same venue. They're slowly dying off, and they don't realize it till it's too late. I really think like the step that needs to happen from like the CPU, and I'll get a little off topic here with the Nationals moving thing, but like with Nationals moving, I think.
Is that from like the IPF directive? Cause there was this rumor mill thing about the IPF needing to move, everyone's Nationals to like the same time course, but I could be wrong about that.
No, that's the executive voting, because no one likes to travel in Canada in the winter, because it's just
okay.
Like traveling in Canada in the winter kind of sucks. There's mm-hmm. risk of delays, snowstorms. Anywhere you go compete is going to be cold. That's just Canada in the winter. So there was this for the last like 3 years, there's been this push to move Nationals to the summer. Mm-hmm. because it's nicer. The problem that comes from that is, one, like, our competitive calendar gets screwed. Like, we've got international teams competing before our Nationals even happens, which doesn't make sense. And then for the next 3 years, it hurts everyone, because then anyone that competes in the summer at like Junior World or something, if they're going to use 2024 Nationals as the selection for the next juniors, it's like, okay, you compete. And then 4 weeks later, you compete again and you have to win to get your world.
Yeah, you better be ready to have another good meet.
But then you also run the risk of aging out, because now that doesn't make sense either. So you can age out now, which is probably...
Right, so you compete, win Nationals as a junior, get your qualification from that. But then the next year, you're 24. So
24 would qualify you for 25. But in 25, you age out. So now you don't go. Which the whole purpose of where we did our Nationals was to limit that, because it was early in the year. And if it's the year you turn 24, you age out, so you wouldn't be a junior anymore. And you don't run mm-hmm. the risk of aging out. Now you run the risk in that cycle for the next 2 years of aging out, which is a problem.
It's a conflict of like calendar year rules, and then having the qualification be like a, you know, overlap of that.
Mm-hmm. And then like the other issue, like traveling in Canada in the summer, the opposite to the winter, is just like, okay, now it's really expensive. and like where Nationals is this year, it's like on an island with like whale watching, lobster pots. Like, it's a very summer based tourist area. So like mm-hmm. the cost is going to be astronomical to get there. And again, like with a lot of teams having to be selected before, so we had to change our selection process, where Nationals for 2024 calendar year is not the only selection criteria, where we can take from other events, you're going to see no one show up to Nationals now. So the Nationals kind of loses its meaning, and then you have Nationals meat directors losing money, and then that scares the next meat director from wanting to run it, because now Nationals isn't making money. So you're starting to move in the wrong direction. Instead of like growing Nationals, Nationals is going to start shrinking, right? So it's the same. It's the same idea of what we're running into at the local level, just on a bigger scale. The meats need to grow, but they're shrinking or they're not kind of aging with the time appropriately.
That is a big bottleneck, for sure. You guys have got a slightly different working structure in terms of like qualification, right? For both like local meats, regional meats, provincial meats, etc. A client of mine, Max, shout out if you're listening, man, mentioned that he's gone over from the UK over here and he's moved over to Canada. And he's saying that he needs to now like volunteer at a meet and do something else in like in the kind of local slash provincial level to then be able to kind of go to nationals as he moves forward. Is that correct? Or is that a kind of province by province thing? How does that kind of work with you guys?
That'd be province by province. I think like for Bryce, you guys are allowed to volunteer to go, I think.
Yeah. So the rule, if I'm not mistaken, and it hasn't changed, would be that you have to either participate in provincials, either as an athlete or volunteer, or you can volunteer at two or three other local meets to make that qualification to be able to go to nationals. And it's in addition to like any totals or whatever you'd have to hit.
Yeah. So Ontario is a little different. So Ontario obviously need your qualifying total, which has to be achieved in 24 months. The lead up to nationals, you need to compete at provincials. Or if you get a bye, you have to volunteer at provincials. The only byes that are given out to Ontario athletes are on international grounds, basically. So you would have already had to have been to international meets to get a bye. So if you're competing within 90 days before or after provincials, you can get a bye, but you have to volunteer at provincials. Or if in the last 3 years you've competed at two international events, you can get a bye as long as you volunteer at provincials. If you don't fulfill those two requirements, though, it's mandatory you have to lift and compete at provincials. And then obviously on the CPU side of things, to get to nationals, you have to have done a regional championship in the last two cycles. So for 2024 nationals, you would have to have done, because of the way the calendar is set up, you'll do 2024 or 2023 centrals to qualify. And then once you've competed at your first nationals, you no longer need to do a regional meet. You just need to maintain your qualifying total and fulfill provincial requirements. So in Bryce's case, it would be QT and volunteer or compete. And on the Ontario side of things, it would be maintain qualifying total and compete at provincials. So a lot of Ontario athletes get in the cycle of nationals, provincials, worlds, nationals, provincials, kind of bouncing back and forth like that.
And do you find that putting those kind of criteria in place like encourages people to actually volunteer more, like above and beyond their station? Or do you find that it just gives meet directors a steady baseline of volunteers and people who are actually willing to show up and help? Because that's the biggest issue, the biggest bottleneck we have over here, man, is like, everything volunteer based. And there's a bit of a running joke around it there at the moment about like, because you have to be a member of the federation to volunteer, there are some people that are literally not just volunteering their time, but they're quite literally paying to volunteer, which absolutely kind of draws a bit of a bottleneck in terms of like people's willingness to volunteer, right? Because you see the same people spotting and loading at every single meet. And it's kind of like, you kind of feel for those people because it's like, they're clearly filling a gap that people otherwise wouldn't be willing to fill, or, you know, the meet wouldn't be able to run without these folks kind of coming through and helping out.
Yeah, so Ontario, you'll see a lot of the same volunteers at a lot of meets. In regards to, like, the provincial buy system, I feel like it actually does the exact opposite. Instead of creating volunteers, I think it takes away from volunteers. And the reason being is you get a lot of people where the mindset is, well, I'm already going to be there. I've already got to drive. Cause again, Ontario is big. So like, say like you're, I don't know, Sault Ste. Marie and it's in Toronto, you're a 7.5 hour drive to get to your provincials. So a lot of people are like, well, if I'm driving 7.5 hours, I'm just going to lift. And you get a lot of people with that mentality with like, well, I'm there, I'm going to lift and I'm going to get my trophy and my t-shirt and problem solved. And I think that's kind of taken away from volunteers. So this year we've actually gone back to splitting up our provincial championship. So our open and masters lift together and our juniors and sub juniors lift together. And it's a weird split you see, because like open provincials with the masters, you seem to be fine for volunteers, because all of the masters lifters volunteer. They all mm-hmm. spot and load. They all hop on a table. Most of them are refs. And again, you have a good amount of open lifters that volunteer. But then if history repeats, you're going to see at junior provincials, it's all of the masters lifters are going to spot and load the juniors. There's no juniors or sub juniors volunteering. There's some open will go if it's local to them, but it's that masters group that really volunteers at all of them. Which was one of the biggest hiccups we ran into last year when it was all championships combined, because masters lifters were not just lifting on one day. They were lifting across 3 days, depending on their weight class, because we had it set where all weight classes lifted together, not age categories. And the thought process was to try and have these sub junior lifters meet like a Ron Strong or a Ron Kilpatrick, like these M1, mm-hmm. M2 lifters that have been around, and kind of like get to know these names and faces. And I mean, truth be told, it didn't really pan out, because they just looked and were like, why am I competing with some old guy who's squatting 100 kilos less than me? This is stupid. It's like, well, okay, that didn't go kind of the way I wanted, but all right. So yeah, it's, I don't know, it's still going to come down to like, the newer lifters need to eventually step up and kind of help, or that's it. That's all. Championships get smaller or just stop happening. There needs to be meet directors, yeah. Needs to be volunteers, or we need to take a step back at the whole structure of the sport and say, okay, do we go the route of like paid platform crews? Like, do we get two platform crews that we can afford to pay? And there you have platform crews. You can rent a platform crew for your meet. For X amount of dollars for a weekend, you've got these five people that will spot, load, do everything, problem solved. Maybe truthfully, that's a route that we have to go. I know like the IPF has, I don't want to get it wrong, I think they're from Czech?
Czech.
Yeah, the Czech.
Yeah, yeah, because they did the 2019 championships. I was there and I see them all the time at internationals.
Yeah, they did 2018 Sweden, 2019 they did. They did...
they were at Sheffield. The Czech career at Sheffield. Yeah.
I feel like they did the Open for 2020 in Sweden as well, I thought, when it went down to the one platform. I could be mistaken. But, yeah, like you get something.
Experienced.
Yeah, you get something like that where you've got, like, five really good people, and it's like, okay, let's go with this. Like I know I ran a championship before where I took – there was a Nationals where they incentivized – platform crews by like the fastest platform crew, like average time to loading and everything like that, won a prize. And I took that structure and I tried using it at, like, a local championship, and again backfired, where people were trying so hard to go fast, there were just so many misloads, errors, mistakes, and it just, like, it was the exact opposite. You got these 13 hour days that should not happen. And yeah, so I think, like,
well, I remember, do you remember 2017 Joel's like ticket system?
Yeah,
I think he basically did like a cash pool. And for each session you volunteered in, you got like an entry.
And then I think they drew
10 winners or something like that.
And everybody got some money,
but the people who volunteered more had a higher chance at the money.
And honestly, like, I thought that was great. I thought that whole Nationals was great.
Yes, it was actually very dope.
That was a wild Nationals. But yeah, like, some sort of incentive system like that is probably what's going to have to happen, because, like, I don't think you're going to get people that want to just give up their weekends out of the kindness of their heart anymore. Like, I think we're past that, where everyone is a little more selfish with their time and their weekends. And it'll get to a point where you can't keep relying on, like, the same four people to drive to every meet. Like, I know, like, when I look at, like, Alberta meets or BC meets, like, I see on the live stream, like, a lot of the same faces. So it feels like it's not just an Ontario thing where it's, like, across the board, you're relying on like these, you know, 8 to 10 people to kind of pick up 20 positions, and it just eventually you're going to lose them. There needs to be more people kind of stepping up to fill those voids. And I think for stuff like that, you've got to look at like the club system. Like Paige, I don't know how you guys do your clubs out there. But like here, like we register as a club, and then I know for events, like I say, okay guys, like there's this event happening this weekend. It's close to us. 5 of us should go out. We'll spot load. And for my end, like I'm like, okay, like if we stay the night, I'll pay the hotel. It is what it is. And I just throw my t-shirts on them for the gym. And it's like, okay, like now there's exposure on a live stream, right? So it comes full circle to like, now it makes sense to have a live stream because it incentivizes me to send a platform crew because I get to advertise, right? So like there's things like that that can be used to kind of like lean on one another that I think meet directors need to look at a little deeper to kind of make it make sense. But yeah, just moving the ball forward, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, the club structure / system over here, there are a couple of clubs. But really, realistically, like we're considering, especially like how big we are in terms of like landmass, we really don't do enough. There are a couple of gyms that really, really put forward tons of people all the time, and certain groups of people that, you know, live together or whatever, that come forward. A lot of it is like within universities over here. And to be fair, that's gotten a lot better in the last few years. There are a few guys over here that have really driven that forward a lot, and really encourage universities to volunteer a lot of, you know, people to platform crews, bot and load, those sorts of things. Because, you know, sometimes a university club will have, I don't know, between 10 and 50 members. And like, they're not all competing at the same time, but they're probably all going to be there, right? So like that platform crew, you know, they definitely could incentivize clubs to put forward, or universities to put forward volunteers. I mean, especially at some events that I'm thinking about, like we recently had a university championships, which I don't know how many lifters were in there, but it was a 5-day event. And all the days were like 13-hour days. You know, we're probably talking 400 or 500 lifters at least. And like they struggled to man a platform crew of 5. And I'm like, how are there this many different universities and this many different people competing, and yet like people aren't able to volunteer? I think there probably could and should be a quota there. I also think that like with memberships being something that drives the sport forward, but also something that doesn't actually cost the federation anything, like why don't you put in some sort of quota that's like, hey, you volunteer at 2 levels, get your membership for free. You know, like you pay for the original one, and then maybe you get it, you know, free the next year if you volunteered twice the year before. Like, even if that's not like covering the cost of traveling there, again, if somebody's going to be there anyway, like if I had a good friend who was who was lifting that day, and I'm like, well, I could sit in the crowd, or I could just spot and load for a 4-hour session and get, you know, in your case, an $80 kickback if I got to do it twice. Like, why wouldn't I do that? Like, I'm closer to the action then, right? Like, there's a lot of stuff that I don't really understand why they haven't just kind of gone with something that's relatively simple. Because it wouldn't be hard for a meet director to just be like, oh, please write down the names of your 5 platform crew. You know, that would be super easy, right? So, you know, I don't know if there's anything like that over there, but there isn't anything like that over here. There is one that is, if you referee at 2 national events over here in the UK, you get your membership for free. And I was a bit like, if I'm not coaching at a national event, I'm not going to drive like 3-4 hours out of my way to go and spend a day there to referee and do that twice. Because that's going to cost me like minimum 3 times, maybe 4 times the amount of my membership. It's like, why would I go out of my way to do that? Personally, for me, that's not worth it. Especially with like powerlifting coach, any weekend that you get off is like kind of sacred. So like, am I really going to go and do that and try and, you know, have that conversation with my partner and be like, yeah, so I'm just going to go and do this thing and volunteer at this place for no reason other than to get, you know, in my case, if I've got to do it twice, it's going to work out at like £25 back, but it's going to cost me £100 in fuel and it's going to cost me a day and a half. Like, That doesn't make sense to me personally. And it has to be a logical, economical decision for somebody to want to do that stuff, right? And at the moment, there seems to be this disconnect, at least over here in the UK, with what they're actually willing to kick back versus, you know, what the actual outcome is. And you see, you have the same problems year in, year out in terms of, you know, certain roles not getting filled and certain volunteering brackets not being fulfilled and that sort of thing. But I don't like to moan. I like to try to come up with potential solutions to these problems, because otherwise it's three dudes who do powerlifting and complaining about how it can be run better, right? Which doesn't solve anything. So, I mean, it sounds like in general the CPU is like I mentioned earlier. You know, you guys have confirmed a lot of my beliefs in terms of like it being run in a way that is slightly in front of where we're at, but you probably still have some of the same teething problems. You mentioned earlier briefly about like meat selling out very quickly. Do you feel like that is because, I mean, it's obvious that the demand's very, very high, but do you also think that the supply of meats themselves are very, very low? And from that low supply of meats, is that simply because the meat director isn't in a position to benefit from the event being run? Do you think it's just simply an economical / political like issue? Like, what do you think the bottleneck is there? Because I mean, maybe there's, I don't know, one or two potential meat directors listening to this being like, you know what, like I run a gym, I can open up my place, I can clear this out, I could run it, and maybe I can make a little bit of money, you know, then it kind of makes sense, right, for somebody to do.
So if you're like an established meat director, you can make a good, like a healthy chunk of money annually running meats. Like I know, like I'm looking at like the current space we've moved to, like running an event here or running an event local to this. Obviously I'm in a different position where I own enough equipment where I can supply everything. I have all my lights, I have my TVs. But if you just look at like the rough numbers, even at say $100 a person, including rent, all of that for a weekend's work, like comfortably I could probably put on a meet any weekend that would do $6,000 profit. So you run, you know, 3-4 of those a year, you're an extra $25,000 a year just running powerlifting events, right? And I think like the people that truthfully stand to benefit the most from running meets are gym owners or mm-hmm. club or people that run clubs and have a relationship and operate outside of a gym. I mean, like, say you don't make a lot of money on the front end. Like you make $100, lose $100, whatever it is, you're getting all of that exposure. You're getting people into the facility. You're building mm-hmm. those connections, and you're starting to kind of build up your own brand that way, in place of just like complaining no meats, telling your athletes there's no meats, not being able to like feed that supply or to supply that demand. Sorry, so a meat director, like the ones that win the most are gym owners, club owners, or like club managers in universities, things like that. So it's anyone that has a relationship, especially if you can do it in a gym, because like the biggest hindrance, like on my end of running a meet, is I've got to move, you know, 15,000 kilos of discs or 1500 kilos of discs. I've got to move 6 racks, 6 bars, take the platforms, load them in the trailer. Like, outside of that, if you're in a gym and you can just shuffle some equipment around and it takes mm-hmm. 2 hours, it's automatically worth it. Like a lot of my events, I'm driving 3-4 hours to put these events on, because like I'm trying to put them in areas that have that demand and need to be serviced, in place of 10 minutes from my house and just making everyone drive to me. So it comes down to gyms or those coaches with gym relationships looking to get involved. And your first meet doesn't have to be like this big 130 person 2-day mega meet. It can be 2 sessions of 2 flights of 28 lifters per session, 1 day start to finish, easy, low overhead. You don't need all the mm-hmm. volunteers. Like if you run like a 1-day meet, you need 20 people max, like including like your referees, your volunteers. Like 20 people can run a 50 some odd person, a 58 person meet comfortably. Like it's not impossible. And a lot of clubs have 20, 25, 30 people kind of involved. So that's definitely what they should be looking at, is like not doing these big grand events and trying to make as much money as possible, but like one day meet, get your feet wet, get comfortable, and then kind of build from there. Like that's 100% what I did. Our first two meets were one day, two session, in, out, easy. And like, I thought those were the most stressful thing in the world I ever did. And then like you slowly progress to like, okay, I'm doing a 4-day meet now. This is way worse. And then
like, even better.
Yeah. Well, and then like even up until provincials, I was debating putting a nationals bid in, and then I did provincials and I'm like, yeah, no, I'm going to wait 2 years and let myself calm down before I have to run nationals. But that's what needs to happen, right? Like, it's like people just, at some point, like I'm just going to keep regurgitating what I'm saying, is at some point you need to get involved at some level of the sport. You need to, at bare minimum, volunteer. And if you're in a position, like you're a club owner, you're a gym owner, and you love the sport of powerlifting, if you want the sport to stick around so that you can make money off of it, the sport needs to continue to grow, and it needs people to get involved, right? Because like the trickle-down effect of meets not happening isn't just like federations start to lose memberships. That spills into like all of us are coaches. If there's no meets happening, there's less people competing. If people aren't competing, the coaching cost start, like people start to look at that and go, oh, well, I'm not competing. Do like I need that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like you start to explore like these other expenses where it's like, okay, well, like instead of a coach, I just rerun the same block that I ran because I'm not competing for 2 years, and now I can afford like the new SBD kit, or I can get the new Romaleos, or something like that, right? Like it starts to trickle into like all avenues of the sport. And then all of a sudden, if coaches aren't able to like make a sustainable income off of coaching, either they step away from coaching completely, or like the product suffers to the point where they're no longer a usable, serviceable coach, and now you've lost coaches. And if that coach was bringing in 10 athletes a year, you've lost 10 athletes a year. Like it just like rolls downhill pretty quickly as you start to like take a step back and back and back. So yeah, volunteers. Volunteers are everything. We need volunteers. or we need
to
pay people.
I'm sorry.
After you.
I think the other end of it is, I think federations should be focusing on like trying to reach out and like meet directors in the middle. So making sure that like people know that they're looking for meet directors, making sure that if somebody steps up or expresses any interest in it, that somebody is like there to be like, here's how you do it. Here's all the steps. Here's the, you know, you can rent this stuff from here. You're going to need to take care of this. Make sure to get food for your volunteers. You know, here's all the places we recommend that you get curtain rods and curtains from so that you can section off the back room. And here's what a staging area should look like. And we've got this stuff that, you know, we can send you, or you can get it from this other gym because we'll connect you. And I think that kind of thing goes a long ways too. I'm sure like, you know, the issue is not enough meets, but it comes from both ends, right? It's like the federation could probably work harder and do more and, you know, try to make it more accessible to host a meet, but also we need people who want access to that knowledge to host a meet, right? Like it gets more complex the more you kind of dissect it, I think, but yeah.
I mean, with you saying that though, dude, like how easy would it be for a federation to be like, hey, we're going to run 50 meets. We've got 100K in the bank right now. We can buy 50 high quality carpets, right? Somebody expresses interest in running a meet. They're like, okay, here's the carpet. Here's the table. Here's this, you know, bang, you know, and then like every weekend that just moves. I mean, it's probably harder for you in Canada, but in the UK, it's not hard to do that. Like either it's a 16 hour day for one person moving, filling a van, driving it down to the next location, or like it's on the meet director, or we get a courier or something to run that kit up and down. But like, it would not be hard to have like a meet director starter pack that exists where you pay $500 and you get a high quality carpet and you get like two rolls of duct tape and you get all the shit that you're going to need to put on a very basic level meet for somebody. And the CPU could even front all those costs and just get it back. In the sense of, okay, you're running a meet, you owe us this much money, and we're going to give you this stuff, right? Which would work fine. It's not like, you know, a roll of carpet's going to expire, or like, you know, you're going to have to throw it out after a year. Like it'll be there and be ready.
Yeah, even within like regions of a province, right? Like you have your kit for Northern Ontario, you have your kit for, you know, Calgary, you have your kit for Edmonton.
That's kind of happened. Yeah. So like BC is like what I would call the glowing example of it working well is they have a trailer, they've got like four racks, bars, plates. And if you're running a meet, they like, they go, they pick up the trailer. I'm not sure the cost of all of this. This is just like my surface level understanding. They drop it off to the meet director. Like I know nationals, like the warm up room, like all of that was BCPA provided all of that. That was not the meet director. Like those blue ER racks, those were all provided by the province. All the plates, all the bars, all the volunteering was through their membership. Ontario's system, and I'm not sure, I don't want to speak to why it failed, but it obviously failed, did kind of similar to what you were talking about, Peach, where we had rack, bar, plates, lights, some plywood, all of that was kind of available, and it was all kept together, and then it was just a meet director would pay X amount of dollars, show up, rent the equipment, take the equipment, bring it back. The problem was more oversight of like the inspection of the equipment, because like 1 year in, the bar was like rusted, the plates were all dinged up, and like some of the, like when I audited the plates, some of them didn't weigh 25 kilos anymore, the bench was ripped, the plywood had never been replaced, like it was just like no one took ownership in that equipment, and that's why it ended up all getting sold off. But something like that is the way to go. Like I've jokingly talked for 3 or 4 years now about getting extra equipment, putting in a trailer and just renting it. Again, it's just like the time it takes to like recoup the cost of that equipment makes it very hard for anyone to look at that and be like, oh, this is a good investment. This is definitely gonna yield a good income over the next 12 years. So like, I think what could be the best route would be if provinces were able to create like a list of meet directors, like similar to how we've done where the meet directors can work with one another. But maybe if they just put a list of meet directors that were willing to like rent their equipment to other gyms or people to use for a day. And you could look and it's like an Airbnb for equipment or something like that, where it's like, okay, like this gym is willing to rent an Eleco rack. It costs more than the ER rack, but it's an Eleco rack. Or, okay, like this one's got 3 ER racks for X amount of dollars. Like something like that might be the way to go, where you can create a budget, look at the equipment you need, look at what you want, and then go pick it up, use it, bring it back, problem solved. But there's still that need to want to run an event, right? And I think, like, we've talked about running, like, meet director clinics in Ontario. And truth be told, like, 3 years ago, we talked about it leading up to COVID. We announced it. One person attended the Zoom call. So it might have changed now. But I'd say, like, even now, like, I maybe talk to one meet director a month that's interested in actually putting on an event. And then you talk through all the steps and everything that's required on them. And out of, I'd say, 1 in 5 actually go through and put an event on. So statistically speaking, it's a low turnover. Obviously, like, there's outliers. Like, we have a couple clubs where, like, they put on their first meet, and before the meet was even done, they put in like 5 other sanctions to run more meets. One thing we've discussed was for new meet directors, we waive their first sanction fee. So like to run an event in Ontario, you have to submit your sanction, which is like your number of lifters, your venue, your emergency contact, your ref, all of that stuff. And there's a fee associated with it. So like a local meet is offhand, I think it's $250 is what you pay the federation. So maybe for something like your first meet, you don't pay the sanction. So it's not a lot, but like it's a little bit of a buffer, right? But I don't know. It's... It just keeps coming full circle to you need to find people that want to do it. And right now it just doesn't feel like people want to. And I feel like that's where we're at.
It is funny that you mentioned BC has basically a trailer full of stuff that they just like bring to whoever wants to direct meets. And you also mentioned that BC's presence at nationals was slightly bigger than Ontario's, indicating perhaps that their federation is growing at a pretty quick rate.
It looks like them and Quebec. Quebec seems to be growing pretty, pretty quick in the last little bit.
So I think part of it is like, well, we'll figure out what they're doing right, right? Like
Quebec gets funding from the government though. So Quebec is provincial.
BC or Quebec?
Quebec.
Okay.
Yeah. So Quebec. So my understanding, and if I get this wrong, someone can correct me. My understanding is if you look on their page, they've got a charitable donations tab. So the way it works is whatever they raise in donations, the government will match and quadruple up to X amount of dollars. So what they do, and I don't know if I'm going to get anyone in trouble for this, but I'm pretty sure what they do is any profit given to the Federation donates to that charity, and then they get four times that back. And that's how they've been funding a lot of stuff in Quebec, with like Quebec coaches get paid for nationals pretty well, equipment, stipends, things like that. They're definitely milking that system, to my understanding, but I mean, you're seeing the growth, right? Like you're seeing, they're averaging like two new gyms a year with like powerlifting equipment pop up. Like in 2018, there was two gyms that were like powerlifting gyms. There's like nine now. So there's definitely like a big demand and growth in that region. BC has always been pretty big into powerlifting. I think a lot of what's happening in BC is there's been kind of this like divergence of the untested or like the lower regulated federations like CPL, WRPF. Those federations kind of like had a falling out. And I think there's like a lot of those tested division lifters in those feds are kind of like just fed up. And they're finally like making the switch as well. But yeah, BC, from what I've seen, definitely has like the most growth lately, as well as Quebec. Quebec obviously just has money. BC, to be honest, I'm not sure what they've changed. But again, like looking at their schedule, like it doesn't look like a crazy amount of meets. The only thing I know BC does is the executive committee runs two of their events a year, I believe. So like, they're guaranteed to have two events run by the executive committee, which years ago Ontario voted not to do because there's too much money to be made in the meets, apparently, and there's a bias where meet directors would make money off of the sport, and it was a whole thing. So like I know like when I ran provincials with Dan and Linda, we ran it because we received no sanction. No one put a bid in, no one wanted to run it. So no, it was just not gonna happen. And then we ran it, and then we got flack from people because we're on the executive and we ran the meet, and that, yeah. So no one wants to run it, but they also, yeah, no one wants to run it, but they don't want other people to run it. It's a whole weird dynamic right now.
I feel for you, man. That's rough. It's rough for you getting heat for running an event that needs to be run for the sake of the sport and the region. And then when you decide to step up and run it in your time, people are like, hey, this guy's charging money for a meet. Like, what the heck?
All that money I made. That's why there's the Lambo in the parking lot, right? living the good life.
I'm definitely going to be sharing the Ontario Powerlifting Meet Director resource for anyone in the show notes that might want to see it. Is there anything like else that you guys would kind of recommend, you know, point people towards? Is there anything you kind of want to mention in terms of just like, I suppose, a general message of this stuff? Because I think the reason I wanted to have this conversation, and I think it's really interesting, is I don't think people quite realize like the significance of whether or not they do or don't do something. So whether or not they're going to be, you know, a referee, a volunteer, like obviously, you know, I'll lay my stake in the ground. If powerlifting didn't exist, I wouldn't have a job. We're all in the same situation there when we kind of say that. So it's kind of like, we do what we can to volunteer where we can and to help the sport grow. And that's not entirely selfless. Like I'm not trying to pretend like I don't have something to gain by volunteering, like, and keeping these meets running. But also, like, people that lift barbells probably want to be some sort of organized way to do that and continue to do that in the future. So, I mean, obviously over here in the UK, we've got, you can referee, you can spot and load. And, you can generally kind of volunteer. You can talk to the guy that runs the gym if you guys have got the competition equipment. You know, the rulings over here are not that strict, and you can get into contact with, get in contact with me and I'll point you towards your divisional head that you need to chat to, or obviously just get directly in contact with like the region and they'll help you out. They need people to run meets. They want people to run meets. And actually, I think in certain situations, not so much in my, just because of like how much, you'd need to pay the gym and stuff like that. But if you are a gym owner and you have the capacity to take on, a meet, then it's probably potentially worth doing for you financially over here, even if you can't quite charge what the guys charge over in Canada. But are there any kind of thoughts that you guys have in terms of places you can point people, conversations, places that people can go if they want to help out more, if, there's anything that they can kind of do to help the sport keep growing? Like, what are your kind of your tidbits to the directions that you could send people?
So the first thing would be like just try and get involved with a club. Even if you're not coached by them, like if you know, like you have some friends that train with a club, go train with them, get involved in the community. And if you want to see events happen, like bring it up. Like you may need to be the one that takes lead or needs to initiate those conversations, but definitely don't be scared to do it. If you're in a club and someone puts the idea forward, once someone's willing to kind of take on the initial leadership role, more people in the club will kind of step up to do it. It just, no one really wants to be that point person that's kind of in charge. That's typically where you see like the most pushback. But yeah, like reach out to your executive committee and say like, hey, if I'm interested in running a meet, what do I need to do? What can you guys do to help me? And just ask for help. The same way like Ontario, like we work with meet directors all the time to try and help them and steer them in the right direction, put them in touch with people, put them in touch with vendors. There's a good chance that whoever's on the executive is a meet director, has run a meet, and has those connections that can kind of make your life significantly easier. So I definitely do that. And then obviously give back to the sport. Like if you're going out there and you've got people catching your barbell, like don't be scared to go out there and help them the next time. There's tons of opportunity to volunteer at events when they happen. So anything from like a check-in table to a score table to a marshal in the warm-up room, like all those roles do need to get filled. So even if you're not comfortable loading and spotting a bar, like you can help at some capacity and just give back to the sport where you can.
Yeah, I mean, my spiel would probably be pretty redundant at this point, but just like volunteer, because you like, we need it. If you have any interest in putting on a meet, like reach out. I will personally connect you with whatever. I will, I have more racks than I need here. I will rent you 2 ER racks. Like, I don't know. I'm throughout this conversation, I think about putting a meet on myself. but like, it needs to happen. And I just went to the Alberta Powerlifting website while you guys were talking there, and went to the page Meet Directors Resources, and it's just under construction, so there's nothing there yet. But if you reach out to me, I will put you in touch with whoever I can. Danny's run a lot of meets, or a couple at least, of very successful meets that athletes were very stoked on. So yeah, I don't know. Do that. Reach out. I'll try to put you in contact with the right people and make sure that you're able to do it. So
awesome. Yeah. There you go. So UK people, get in contact with me. I'll send you the UK base, and then Bryce will direct you Canada wise. If you're somewhere else, I'm not pointing in the right direction. Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah,
but reach out anyway.
Yeah, we can try. Don't be shy. We'll try.
Where can you guys be found? Garrett, you're doing some cool stuff. Where can people harass you for hosting meets?
Yes, so they can go Instagram, Garrett Bentley, or Barry Barbell Club.
Bryce, where do you want to be found, man? And what are you saying to the world at the moment?
What's up? No, I'm Calgary Barbell pretty much everywhere. If you want to follow my personal Instagram, it's Bryce_CBB. But yeah, same old guy, you know me.
You can find me at Peach Squats. You can find my coaching over at Italian Barbell, and you can find the podcast at Buy1@8 on Instagram. Please do leave the show a review. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know, you know, what you want to see more of in the future. If topics that we haven't covered, anything like that, we would love to hear from you guys. And that's us signing out.